College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03, midweek Wednesday afternoon, February 5th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Hart. This year's Super Bowl appears to be lacking the typical pregame excitement and anticipation. We'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, a report on private payrolls is out today ahead of Friday's government jobs report for January. We're joined by Rick Cobb, founder of the workplace consulting firm 2Discern in Chicago. Rick, thank you for joining us today. And as is the case every jobs week, the private payroll processor ADP goes first on Wednesday morning. And their snapshot of the labor market showing that private payrolls expanded by 183,000 in January. That was above analysts' expectations. However, the distribution of that of those 183,000 estimate was far from even.
Right. Well, there's a couple things to think about. One of them is that, you know, ADP is a for-profit business, and their customer base tends to significantly represent the Fortune 1000. So a lot of the data they put out there for you isn't probably reflective of what's going on in the small and even the mid-sized to small businesses. We don't even really have a good way to look at that. It's very hard to get that data or sample it other than what the government does in terms of their report. So there should be some differences when we look at those in the next day or so.
Yeah, that always explains where there's kind of a wild discrepancy between the ADP number on Wednesday and the government number on Friday morning. And that is, this is merely private payrolls. The government measures government hiring, and it's different types of methodology, too. I mean, the government jobs report is a survey with an enormous sample size.
Right. And I think the other thing that we don't look at enough is the quits. The people that actually leave jobs and go to other jobs, those that go out into the market to look, that's a sign, that's a more accurate sign probably of the future stability, or at least the people's opinions about how the economy looks. They're willing to bite the bullet and go out into the market and try to find something else. And that's a harder thing to get at as well. Now, it is relatively good news. And of course, that news gets played by whoever wants to take credit for it. It's a really interesting data point, Rob, that I ran into the other day, and I thought I wanted to share this with you. So Pew did a study not too long ago, Pew Research, and it turns out that Illinois is one of the two states out of 50 that most accurately represents the total population for the United States in terms of economics, diversity, stratification across income ranges, all of that. It's kind of an interesting thing to think about as we look at this data.
It's all, yeah, you bring up a very good point, especially when it comes to the urban-rural divide as well. Very quickly, though, Rick, if you're out there in these streets and you are looking for a job right now in this market, what are you hearing from people who are in the recruiting business?
Well, I think the recruiters are really feeling the pinch. And I probably have more conversations with people at the top of the house. So we're looking at that sort of the VP executive level opportunities. And it's been really tight. I don't necessarily look at that as a long-term issue because, you know, one of the things that happens economically for companies is uncertainty causes paralysis. So no one wants to get caught staffing up or cutting way back when it turns out the economy has swung wildly the opposite direction of your actions. And so they tend to just kind of sit on their hands and wait. What that means for us in Illinois is, you know, we tend to be somewhat more middle of the road across the board. We don't rise as high or fall as low as market segments or other specific areas of the economy. So I think we're just going to see a lot of not really sure, kind of wandering around, bouncing along, nothing really materially happening until there's more concrete news to the positive or negative.
Rick Cobb, founder of the workplace consulting firm 2Discern in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Coming up, the Super Bowl is Sunday, so Where's the buzz?
Lunch money for all generations. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
This year's Super Bowl buzz feels slightly muted with a familiar favorite and a very active news cycle. Let's discuss the muted buzz with Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Vertair Group in Chicago. Tim, thank you for joining us today. Now, when it comes to the Super Bowl discussion, I mean, right now, watching a sports entertainment program where the host is at Radio Row in New Orleans. So clearly there is a great deal of discussion of the Super Bowl on sports TV and on sports radio and on sports new media. But it seems like outside of the sports bubble, people aren't really talking about the Super Bowl. And is that just simply a function of a been there, done that matchup, or is all the action in Washington these days?
Well, it's a very good point. I struggle myself with what's going on in media generally, and perhaps where the Super Bowl, sort of the king of all events, sort of sits. And this week has decidedly been less than, I think, than in previous years. I think there are some micro excuses for that, and I think there clearly are some macro issues sort of at play, too. I think you hinted at it. I think one of the big macros is in the media space, right? There is a fire hydrant, a fire hose of news and information and speculation and whatever other adjectives you want to sort of throw into that mix coming out of Washington. There is just an exhaustion, I think, point where the Trump administration has followed through on its stated mission to flood the zone with whatever performative activities they have, in store. And I think a lot of people are fatigued. Now, that said, you know, arguably the Super Bowl being the sort of mega wattage event in American culture, right, should be a respite from all of that. But I think it's getting very tiring, I think, for people to sort of keep abreast of media, what's going on, and news and information. And I think it's crowding out the sports dialogues and the lead-ups of the stories for the big game. And, we'll see what that sort of translates to in terms of the ratings. But there's no question that the airtime, if you will, for the historic lead-up storylines for the Super Bowl are getting crowded out.
Well, it's also the storylines are largely a rerun, too. We have a matchup from 2 years ago, the Eagles and the Chiefs, and the thing that really attracted everybody to the Super Bowl last year, and that is the undeniable star power of Taylor Swift being coupled to the Kansas City Chiefs dynasty. Even that is a little old this time, and it seems like the Chiefs have turned into the bad guys.
Well, I think there's definitely a little bit of a over-familiarity, perhaps, with these teams and these storylines, and even Taylor Swift, frankly. But I also think, too, that there has been a lot of conjecture over the course of the last year or so that maybe there's just too much football on television as well. Now, the Super Bowl is an exception of all exceptions, right? But we've talked about this before, right? Sort of the endless creep, if you will, of not only college, but certainly the NFL into various nights and days of the year where there's just a game every single day, it seems, and perhaps maybe too much of the game, so to speak, right? So, again, the Super Bowl always sort of, you know, outperforms that, but there is a fatigue there. I think there's an oversaturation, perhaps, of the game, and maybe there is a little too much football, as evidenced, for example, in the ever-declining Pro Bowl ratings, which occurred over the weekend. I completely forgot about it. I think many fans did too this year.
I feel like, though, we're going to have this discussion today, Tim, and then we're going to find out on Monday morning that it was the most watched television event of all time, and yet we said there was a distinct lack of buzz. But you also point to another problem, and that is football is the only thing that can attract eyeballs to linear, broadcast, or cable television. Otherwise, you're just watching cheap reboots of the $24,000 pyramid.
Yeah, I'll put my bet, though, on this. I do think we're at peak football. We might be even at peak live sports. We'll see. It's an enduring event. I think it's not necessarily going to be aided and abetted by the fact that our two biggest countries nearby, which also contributes to viewership in Canada and Mexico, are not necessarily enamored with the American lifestyle right now. So I don't know. We'll see what those numbers look like. I'll take that bet.
Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Viterra Group in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, seeking out tax breaks for homeowners.
Cash, credit, debit, and totally free. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday. One of the benefits of being a homeowner is the potential for tax deductions. Let's look at some of them with Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago. Drew, thank you for joining us today. And someone in my life is buying a home for the very first time, and the when you're in the first time homeowner stage, you're writing out a lot of very big checks, and maybe the largest checks you've ever written in your life, and it can be very intimidating. But a home is an investment, Drew, as you know, and it can be a source of substantial tax savings along the way.
Yeah, it sure can, Rob. America's dream is not always what it's cut out for, right? I mean, it's a great thing, but it does come with some expenses. But there are some great opportunities too that we can certainly talk about, and there are some breaks that can be provided as we approach tax season here.
Well, two of the biggies are you can write off your mortgage interest and your property taxes. And what are some of the rules regarding the mortgage interest and property taxes? Tax deductions.
Certainly. The you know, many people, that's the biggest tax thing, right? So you can deduct your mortgage interest, but you have to be able to itemize first, right? You need to be able to itemize so you can deduct your interest up to on a $750,000 debt, you know, if you're doing this jointly. But if you're filing separately, it's $375,000. So the allowable mortgage interest tax deduction, you know, it differs for, you know, taxpayers, but based on how they're filing. So realistically, what that means is the interest that you paid on your mortgage every month is deductible. So the same thing with the taxes. Your tax that you pay every month, that is a deductible item as well when you file your taxes, but you have to itemize. So you have to qualify first to be filing your taxes in the itemized basis as well. So if you are just, you know, doing a return where you're not itemizing, then these two wouldn't apply to you guys.
And you can also get credits for energy-saving home improvements or for installing electric vehicle charging equipment in your garage, whether it's attached or detached. And when we talk about energy-saving home improvements, I mean, the big one, obviously, and I know a number of people have taken advantage of this, is allow that tax credit to pay for the installation of solar panels, but that's just one of many things that you can do.
Yeah, that for sure. The other thing is the, you know, the electric vehicle credits that they're giving. You know, you put in a battery charger in your house, the opportunity to deduct a percentage of that for the charging of the vehicle. You're allowed to deduct up to $1,000 for that. There, you know, if you make that a bi-directional or bi-directional, I believe, it allows it to, you know, go back to the grid. You know, there's a form that you can fill out to allow that, but they'll give you credit for that. And if you're, you know, if you're able to put in some of the cost-saving things like the, you know, the furnaces and some of the equipment, the energy-efficient furnaces and heaters and things, they're going to give you the, you know, deductible credits for that as well. I mean, those things are great as well. And the solar panels, I mean, for now, those are deductible. But, you know, I think there's a bill out there, there's conversation out there that is talking about maybe eliminating that. So kind of keep your ear out to see if that's going to be something that they're going to continue to allow.
Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago, thank you for joining us today. Still ahead in Personal Finance Wednesday, looking for financial compatibility in a life partner.
This is Chicago's news, traffic, and weather station, News Radio 105.9. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. A judge rules on one of the executive orders issued during the first days of the new administration. In personal finance Wednesday, being on the same page with a partner when it comes to money. And Valentine's Day is poised to show a lot of love to retailers. WBBM Business, the markets are mixed right now. The Dow is up 153 points. The NASDAQ is down 25. The S&P 500 is up 8. We have 29 degrees right now in Chicago under cloudy skies, going up to 32 today. Some wintry weather on the way. Freezing rain, freezing drizzle later this afternoon and into this evening. A winter weather advisory takes place. It takes effect starting at 6 o'clock tonight. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. The international community is reacting to President Trump's statement that the United States should take over the Gaza Strip and, quote, level it out. This is CBS News contributor Robert Berger.
You know, this is sort of a shock and awe kind of a proposal, and maybe now it'll be at least the starting point for some kind of discussion and trying to find some way to reach a solution that might not include at least the traditional idea of a Palestinian state.
The president made the comments during a joint news conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday. A federal judge is blocking President Trump's attempt to end automatic U.S. citizenship for children born on U.S. soil to undocumented or temporary immigrants. The nationwide injunction is expected to remain in place until a pending legal case is resolved or a higher court overturns the ruling. In the order, the judge ruled President Trump's executive action conflicts with the 14th Amendment and contradicts 125 years of Supreme Court precedent. It's 12:32 as the Noon Business Hour continues. Markets are mixed. We welcome in Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at MacroTides.com in San Diego. Jim, thank you for joining us today. And tech, once again, weighing on the markets, or at least the NASDAQ. And this is based on both the figures from Alphabet, the parent company of Google, and chipmaker AMD. Why did Google disappoint?
Well, I think it comes down to a number of things. The amount of money that they're spending and plan to spend. China mentioned Google, that they may bring some legal action against them. So I think it's a combination of things. Plus, Google had made a pretty good move to the upside, Rob. So I think it's a combination of reasons why it's pulling back as sharply as it is.
Now, when it comes to AI and how tech companies are graded by the markets on their AI efforts, is it just enough to say that we're working on it and investing in it these days, or do you actually have to demonstrate some results at this stage in the game?
That's a wonderful question and pointed. Rob, I think that we're in that point where people are just happy that companies are spending money on it. It justifies, if you will, buying NVIDIA, as we're seeing it, it bounced today. But there is a valley coming at some point in time where companies don't realize a real return on how much money they've already spent. And that will lead to a decline in demand. There's the other threat that we saw with DeepSeek is that this can become a commodity, as often has been the case over the last 30 years. A new technology comes into place and it's wonderful, and then it attracts more capital and all of a sudden prices go down. So there's a valley coming in this stuff, Rob, because at some point in time people are going to ask the second part of your question, and I don't think companies are going to be able to provide a good answer. So that's what's coming, I think, sometime in the next 12 months.
Well, I feel like if you take the long view of history, you go back 25 years when the dot-com bubble burst in 2000 and 2001, maybe you could the transformative power of the internet just wasn't there yet at the time. But very suddenly, and in a way that very few people predicted, social media came along and not only upended the internet, but how we interact with with media in general. And then you saw cloud computing and then very much the promise of the internet, which maybe seemed like an illusion in 1999, in 2000, was finally fully realized about a decade later. Is that a situation we could see in AI, where we just say to ourselves, well, there's not really a whole lot happening with it right now. And then you get to 2035 and you say, oh, wait a minute, what happened?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good analogy, whether it'll be a full decade for that to be realized or not. Just an enormous amount of money is being thrown at this. And I understand the benefits. At the same time, your first question in terms of, well, investors at some point in time want to know, okay, you spent this much on hardware to be able to do AI. What benefits are you getting right now in terms of it flowing down to the bottom line? And those will be the tough questions that are going to happen. And I think you'll see a shakeout, maybe not as severe as what we saw after the dot-com, because you know most of these companies are real companies that are involved with solid businesses. But I think that question is going to get asked, Rob. And I think there's a valley coming in this stuff. The one thing I'll point out, despite all this hoopla, the semiconductor index peaked in July of last year and is down about 15% from that peak. So to me, that seems to be a warning that all is not well in this space. But right now, people are still focused, I think, on bidding up anybody who's involved.
Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager of MacroTides.com in San Diego. Coming up next in Personal Finance Wednesday, deciding whether you're in a financially compatible relationship. We'll run down the criteria.
Cashing in with conversation. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday, and we're going to focus on Valentine's Day as in the next two segments of the Noon Business Hour, starting on views on money and how it can be a poison pill for a relationship. We welcome in Carolyn McClanahan, founder of Life Planning Partners in Jacksonville. Carolyn, thank you for joining us today. And I feel like the Noon Business Hour, it's a little bit about dollars and cents, Carolyn, but I also feel like we're the relationship show too, because a lot of the issues that people have with money can really be solved by just having a conversation with the important people in your life, with your partner in your life. And this is definitely a situation in which having a conversation early on can stave off a lot of heartbreak and stress later on.
Oh, you're exactly right. Money is one of the big reasons people get divorced, and having an understanding about money up front can hopefully let you have long, healthy relationships where you can grow old in good financial security together.
Now, when we're talking about financial compatibility, we're not talking about, hit them with the credit check before the first date, or do we?
Well, it's very important to understand how each part of the couple feels about money. You know, there are different money personalities. There's a great book I give to all clients who are entering a serious relationship. It's called First Comes Love, Then Comes Money. And I did not write the book. It was Bethany and Scott Palmer. And it talks about discovering whether you're a spender or saver, or whether you have a risk-taking mindset or a security-type mindset. And learning your personalities up front lets you put in place ways to negotiate those differences in personality.
When we talk about a spending mindset versus a saving mindset, what is kind of a scenario that you come up with to illustrate that concept?
Oh, goodness. I think spenders and savers actually make a good couple, because the spender gets the saver to live a little and the saver gets the spender to not blow it all so they don't have financial security in the future. And so perfect example is making sure everybody knows how much money they have to spend, how much they have to save, and then the two negotiating what are their values around what they want to spend their money on and coming up with something they can both agree on.
Now, when we talk about financial compatibility, I think one offshoot of that is financial infidelity. And how many people out there, I mean, this seems absolutely just baffling to me as someone who's been married for almost 14 years, but that you would hide significant amounts of money coming in from your partner, or have secret purchases, or even a secret credit card or a secret checkbook. I mean, the stress of knowing that existed would just drive me up a wall. So, but people do it. And how many people do that over the course of their life?
Well, it's not uncommon, and the problem is people haven't had good discussions and financial transparency up front. You joked about the credit check, but it is important if you're going to get serious with somebody, move in with them, marry them, that you guys know each other's credit score and you know how you whether you handle credit responsibly. Because once you're married to them, you could become responsible for part of that. And that's why it's important to have good conversations and agree to not have financial infidelity and hide things from each other. Now, that's a little bit different. So people need their own money, because sometimes you may want to go buy your spouse a surprise, and if they're getting a ding on every credit card that you charge on where they can see what surprise you bought them, that's not healthy either. But everybody needs to know that what's going to be spent is going to be divulged eventually. And also making sure you have agreements on what can you buy on your own without discussing it. I know one client that went and bought a car without telling his spouse that he was going to buy a new car. And, you know, our family, that would be like, that's not something we would do. But, you know, is there a dollar limit? Like if you're going to spend over $200, should we talk about it, or $1,000? So having those discussions and agreeing how money's going to be spent up front reduces the risk of financial infidelity.
And it seems like that's a conversation where you can also have a reset at every different stage of your life, because what may be a large expense when you're single or maybe a large expense before you get married could actually seem like a modest expense when you have kids, because children are a lot of things, but they're also very expensive.
Oh, you're exactly right. And financial planning is an ongoing process. And so, you know, you think about going to a financial planner, but just within yourselves, you got to pay attention throughout the years, because life does change about how much you're spending, how much you need, what your goals are, especially as people are approaching the day when they're no longer want to work. What's that look like financially to both, to make sure they're on the same page? Because people can be together 20, 30 years, get ready to retire, and then they have totally different ideas about how they want to spend money in retirement.
Carolyn McClanahan, founder of Life Planning Partners in Jacksonville, Florida, thank you for joining us on Personal Finance Wednesday. Be sure to join us at this time tomorrow for Technology Thursday. And still to come, tallying up the spending for Valentine's Day.
Money conversation that pays a big dividend. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Valentine's Day is big business, with spending expected to hit $27 billion this year. Let's talk about it with Bob Phibbs, the CEO of The Retail Doctor in New York. Bob, thank you for joining us today. $27 billion on Valentine's Day. And so where does that put Valentine's Day on the list of holidays where people spend a lot of money? Obviously, Christmas is the undisputed champion, but where does Valentine's Day fall between Halloween and Thanksgiving?
Well, it's still below Halloween, but $27 billion is nothing to sneeze at. And I have a quick question for you, my friend. Who is more likely to celebrate the holiday, women or men?
Boy, that is a really good question. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know.
Men are more likely to celebrate this year, with 55% saying they plan to participate, up from 51% last year.
Well, we got to build up some relationship equity, Bob. That's why.
Hey, and you know what the fifth most popular gift option is jewelry, which only the fifth most popular, but it's still expected to be about a quarter of shoppers are going to be buying jewelry. So it's great. And you know what I think is so fun about all of this is the rest of the world has woken up to what retailers understood a long time ago, which is, holy crap, I need something new to be able to get people to get excited about. And so whether it's you guys are dyeing the Chicago River green, or it's going to be Labor Day or whatever, it's just an excuse to be able to go out and celebrate. And after we got through the pandemic, I think we've seen that all skyrocket across all holidays. It just gives an excuse to go out and spend. And yeah, the naysayers are like, oh, it's all going to end tomorrow, which they've been saying for, I don't know, 6 years now. But the reality is the consumer is spending, and they're doing it to treat themselves.
Now, my Valentine's Day spend is going to be primarily getting candy and cards for the kids to pass out in their classroom on February 14th. And that seems like that's pretty consistent through time. I mean, that was the case 30 years ago when I was in grade school. But has Valentine's Day always been a $27 billion holiday? I mean, what has really turned this holiday into a retail juggernaut? Is it just a lot of COVID revenge spending, or were there other factors at play?
No, I think that really is kind of the way it is. And the spend has gone up like a lot in just the last 4 years, I think it was. I was trying to find if I had my stats on it. I couldn't find it in front of me. But, you know, the average spend is $189, man. So you better go get some more cards and get to the average.
Well, yes, I'm going to buy 13 bags of heart-shaped M&Ms because once it goes to school with the kids, I can just, you know, nosh on them for the rest of the year.
Exactly. Bob, you know, and those little candy hearts now have a code on them. So if you give them to your girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, you can go online and register it as, you know, you're going to marry them. So people are finding innovative ways now to use what we thought was just a once and done and finding new ways to grow brands, which
is
very exciting.
There's nothing like saying I love you by giving someone candy that has the taste and texture of Maalox. Bob Phibbs, CEO of The Retail Doctor in New York.